The next session we'll have is a panel discussion on how we can make Northern Ireland have the best regional economy in Europe. We're pleased to have guests from outside the Alliance Party to discuss this important matter with us. The session will be chaired by Trevor Lunn MLA. Trevor's our party's enterprise spokesperson, and he will introduce the guests who are with us today. You understand that question cards have been circulated and a roving microphone will be available. So if you want to contribute, make sure you fill in the question cards. They'll be submitted, and then make sure that when you're asking your question that the microphone's with you so everyone can hear the contributions. So I'll pass over to Trevor as chair of this panel discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Good afternoon, everybody. Can I ask our guests to just come up to the table, please? I think. I think we're still short of one panelist, but we'll. Oh, here she is. Were you waiting for applause? Okay, welcome, Deirdre, and welcome, everybody. Good to see you. The theme of this discussion is very simple. It's on your programme, and it looks like a very simple question. Can we make Northern Ireland the strongest regional economy in Europe?
Hello, Deirdre.
A huge question, which covers so many facets and the things we've already talked about today in a lot of respects about our skills of innovation, our productivity gap, our level of economic inactivity here. The Jim Fitzpatrick last night, for those of you who were at the dinner, gave us a very, very thoughtful discussion on the way forward, on the need for change and the need for speed of change. And he gave us some very good examples, which did, if it did nothing else, it certainly highlighted that the Northern Ireland Assembly hasn't covered itself in glory in the last number of years in terms of any change or speed of change. In fact, the word snail's pace comes to mind. Other things such as our connectivity, our energy costs, our broadband, and I've heard people, you know, potential inward investors talking about our lack of activity and progress on social issues, some of the things we've touched on today. So the question for our panel is, it's not just purely around the economics of it, there's a lot more to it than that. I'm going to ask them, and I'm going to introduce them first of all, but then I will ask them to give us up to 5 minutes, and we'll be reasonably flexible about it, guys, within reason, just on their thoughts about this issue. So in no particular order, we have Michael Bell from the Northern Ireland Food and Drink Association. Just put your hand up, Michael. Yep. Michael has over 29 years' experience in the food industry. He worked in the bakery trade in Northern Ireland and Malta for 14 years. During this period, he worked closely with major retailers and obtained a place on the senior management board of the Ormond Bakery. He obtained a food science honours degree from Queen's University Belfast, and he holds several other food-related qualifications. He's a chartered scientist and a fellow of the Institute of Food Science and Technology. He has been involved in developing that institute since its foundation in 1996. And he is also an elected member of the Northern Ireland Assembly Business Trust. Peter Bunting, my immediate right, is the Assistant General Secretary for the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. He has the responsibility of coordinating and developing the trade union movement in Northern Ireland. The ICTU is a single umbrella organisation for trade unions on the entire island of Ireland. The Northern Ireland Committee is a representative body for approximately 36 trade unions with 231,000 members across Northern Ireland. So I think we'd do well to get on with Peter. Prior to his appointment to Congress, Peter served as General Secretary of the National Bus and Rail Union in the Republic of Ireland, and he's held several representative positions within the NBRU, from shop steward to General President. He holds a BA Honours from the Faculty of Business, Economic and Social Science, Trinity College, Dublin. Gerry Campbell took up his post as Chief Executive of Colleges Northern Ireland in 2011. He was previously the chief executive of the Northern Ireland Commission for Children and Young People. Between 2008 and 2011, he was the director of corporate services with the Northern Ireland Social Care Council between 2002 and 2008. And between 1999 and 2002, Jerry was the regional commercial training manager for the British Red Cross, responsible for all commercial training activities in Northern Ireland, Scotland and the Isle of Man. He is currently the Northern Ireland Chair of Extern, the Independent Audit Committee Chair for the Commissioners for Older People for Northern Ireland, Chair of the Board of Governors of a school in Antrim. Jerry, I could go on half the afternoon here, but that's probably... Professor Deirdre Heernan needs no introduction, but I'm going to give her one anyway. She was appointed the Pro Vice Chancellor of Communication and the Provost, Colina McGee, as of 1st of September 2012. And she was appointed to the Irish President's Council of State as one of the seven personal nominees of President Michael D. Higgins. A distinguished researcher, author, broadcaster, member of Commentator's Corner on The View. She is a member of the Institute for Research in Social Sciences and has published widely on healthcare, education policy, social care and devolution. She is a co-founder and former co-director of the Northern Ireland Life and Times Survey. In 2001, she was the recipient of a Distinguished Teaching Award. This was followed by a prestigious National Teaching Fellowship by the Higher Education Academy in 2008. 2006, that's why I put my glasses on. In 2008, she secured an ESRC Fellowship and spent 9 months as policy advisor in the office of the First and Deputy First Minister. She's a director of ILEX, Derry Londonderry Urban Regeneration Company, and a school governor on the board of Foyle College. And she also recently chaired the Heenan Anderson Independent Commission into the Northern Ireland economy. Now, I'm going to ask our, as I said, our panelists to give us their thoughts on the original question, up to 5 minutes at a time. And since, Peter, you're the closest to me, you can go first.
Thank you, Chair. Conference. I find it very difficult for a trade unionist to speak for less than 5 minutes or 5 minutes. It's a very difficult demand to make upon me. However, I do thank you all and welcome the opportunity to give the Northern Ireland Committee of the ITTU's views on Brexit at this conference. We have to date witnessed much commentary from those who are supportive of Brexit, both in GB and Northern Ireland. Some of the economic benefits from a Brexit, posited by those who favour Brexit, fly in the face of rational thinkers. And I want to quote from the Financial Times annual report dated the 4th of January 2016. Few issues unite economists, but Brexit is one of them. They overwhelmingly believe leaving the European Union is bad for British economic prospects. In the Financial Times annual poll of more than 100 leading thinkers, not one thought a vote for Brexit would be beneficial to the United Kingdom's economic growth in 2016. And this, you would agree, is a startling, improbable statistic from those who are experts in the dismal science of economics. The majority of the trade union movement concur with that finding. Brexit, in our opinion, will lead to a fast reduction of economic activity in Northern Ireland, resulting in the loss of many, many jobs in manufacturing, in the agri-food business, and other sectors of our economy. Those who believe Northern Ireland will benefit from a Brexit due to an increase of funding from Westminster are living in cloud cuckoo land. Despite international pressure on David Cameron during the past 2 years of negotiations on the Stormont House Agreement and the Fresh Start Agreement to allocate additional funding for economic growth in Northern Ireland so as to ameliorate the plight of those in marginalised communities and to cement the peace project, David Cameron resisted all overtures. If he was resilient to that pressure then, there is no obvious reason to suggest otherwise. In contrast, EU funding for Northern Ireland will amount to an excess of £3 billion between 2014 and 2020. And just let me give you a breakdown on that funding, because this is real funding. Over £2.1 billion under CAP, the Common Agricultural Policy, £308 million under ERDF, the European Regional Development Fund, £206 million under ASF, the European Social Fund, £469 million under Peace and Interreg, £550 million if calculating on a cross-border basis, and £18 million under EFF, the European Fisheries Fund, plus other as yet unquantifiable receipts under Horizon 2020, COSME for SMEs, and Erasmus, which is related to education. There is not a hope in anybody's view that the Tories will make up that deficit, which we will be in receipt of as per being a member of the European Union. Much of our reasoning behind the decision to oppose Brexit stems from the experience of benefits accrued by workers through progressive employment and human rights due to membership of the European Union. I want to list those out for you, because sometimes people don't believe, and they go off to this old one, and you'll hear it about our assembly as well. What did the Romans ever do for us? Well, let's just reiterate what they have done for workers' rights right across the European Union, and indeed in Northern Ireland. The right to 20 days paid annual leave a year, the right to not be forced to work longer than 48 hours a week on average, the right to paid time off for antenatal appointments and protection for pregnant women and new mothers in the workplace, the right to up to 18 weeks parental leave per child and to time off for urgent family reasons, the right to equal pay for work of equal value between men and women, the right to equal treatment for part-time, fixed-term and agency workers with other employees, the right for workers' representatives to be informed and consulted on significant changes that could affect jobs, the right to high standards of health and safety at work, and protections for workers affected by outsourcing or business buyouts. In the event of a Brexit, out campaigners would withdraw all such employment rights. Our union, our movement, is deeply committed to a social Europe, although deeply concerned with the EU and how it has adopted a neoliberal economic direction and an ill-thought-out policy to combat austerity. Obsession with austerity damaged social well-being. Indebtedness for nations came before or from saving banks. That led to a decrease in pressure on wages, decreased productivity, decreased industrial relations, and a decrease in economic growth. However, we, as hopefully you all agree, should remain inside the tent and lobby for progressive reforms in pursuit of Jacques Delors' dream of a social Europe. To opt out now would lead to a net welfare loss for all citizens across Northern Ireland. And sometimes one comes to a feeling that despite all the empirical evidence which is presented, your gut has a great thing of telling you what's right and what's wrong. And specifically in relation to those who are arguing against something you believe in. And I'm a great believer that when I look around and see UKIP and Nigel Farage and other such people in Northern Ireland arguing for a Brexit, then my gut tells me, despite all the empirical evidence, that I cannot be associated with such people. Thank you for listening.
Okay, Peter, thank you very much. I should make it clear, conference, that we haven't asked any of these speakers to agree with the Alliance Party policy, and that's not, they're all entirely independent of the Alliance Party. And if they happen to agree with us, that's just a bonus for us today. But they haven't been selected in any way to be supportive of our attitude to this. So our next speaker is Jerry. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Trevor, and good afternoon, conference. I'm the Chief Executive of Colleges Northern Ireland, which is the sectoral body for the six further education colleges. And the firm position that we have is that the United Kingdom should remain as part of the European Union. As an FE sector, we have progressed and transformed ourselves over the past decade. And in terms of the future, building on the successes that the Minister, who has worked very, very closely with the sector, and the new Further Education Means Success strategy, we believe that if we're going to truly transform the economy and the role that FE plays within that, that we can only do that as part of the European Union. And whilst clearly there do remain significant challenges ahead for the Assembly in terms of sustaining the right levels of investment in education and in further education, however, we do believe that there are opportunities for the economy over the next period of time and for our people if we can match the right levels of investment alongside other levers such as the reduced rate of corporation tax, which can go some strong way to contributing and making Northern Ireland one of the strongest, if not potentially the strongest, regional economy in Europe. But the only way that we can actually realise these aspirations is if the UK does remain firmly as part of the European Union. And it's nice to be on a panel and I'd be very much in agreement with what Peter has said. We don't always agree on everything, but it's nice that today I think we are very much in agreement with the positions that we have. Rebuilding and rebalancing the Northern Irish economy and moving out of the deepest recession in living memory and building a shared society for all of our people after so many years of conflict are actually very challenging enough in their own right. But to be faced with the possibility that the UK could actually leave the European Union, I believe is an additional challenge that we could actually do without at this period of time. The FE colleges themselves have become much more outward looking in their focus, and particularly over the past number of years, they've developed very strong links and relationships with other educational institutions, employers, students and staff from right across countries within the European Union. And the colleges have built up significant levels of capability in terms of participating within a range of European programmes, whether that be successful engagement in lifelong learning, Erasmus Plus programmes or Interreg 5. And I want to give you some examples as to how working within Europe has actually benefited the FE colleges and I believe has been beneficial to our students, to our staff and to the overall Northern Ireland economy. The creation of the CREST Centre in Southwest College, where a new centre for renewable energy and sustainable technologies was established with the aims of encouraging innovation in emerging sectors and positioning the cross-border region as an engine for the development of smart and innovative technologies. And again, that is supported through European funding. The fact that the Southern Regional College is one of only three FE colleges in the entire UK to be awarded the Erasmus Plus VET Mobility Charter, which specifically recognises the operational capacity of the Southern Regional College to manage high-quality mobility projects and support greater internationalisation through vocational education and training. The fact also that the South Eastern Regional College is the only FE college in the UK to secure an Erasmus Plus project outside of a European partner, where the college has built extensive links with the university, with the National Institute of Technology, Toyama College in Japan, and an Institute of Technology in Thailand. And again, as Peter had and Trevor, I think, had referenced, given that Northern Ireland is the only part of the UK to share a land border with another EU member, the FE colleges have built very, very strong relationships with our counterparts in the Republic of Ireland, whether that be through student and staff mobility or through the sharing of best practice. Europe is vitally important to our FE colleges. We're very much an outward-looking sector who see ourselves very much as part of Europe and value the fact that participation within EU programmes has allowed our colleges to learn from and share best practices right across Europe, ultimately to the benefit of our students and ultimately to the benefit of growing a very strong and sustainable economy. And whilst many of us at a personal level do believe that there do need to be elements of reform within the European Union. The way to approach this is within the European Union itself, and not to be trying to do it from outside. Further education stands on the threshold of very exciting opportunities through the establishment of the new Department for the Economy, and the new departmental strategy, Further Education Means Success. And it is within Europe that FE firmly sees Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom remaining if we are to realise these opportunities in the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerry. Could I just remind you folks that there's an opportunity for questions when we're finished here. There are roving mics. If you want to ask a question but don't want to ask it yourself, put it on one of the cards and give it to me. We'll do our best to get them in. So thanks for that. Next speaker is Michael Bell. Michael.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Conference, for the invite. First, a little bit about who is Northern Ireland Food and Drink. We're the largest contributor to sales, exports and employment in the private sector in Northern Ireland. We're over 100,000 jobs. Those 100,000 jobs are spread across farming, food manufacturing, cold stores, laboratories, food packaging, a whole panorama of jobs. You will hear people talk about the supply chain. It's actually a phrase I'm not that keen on, because it implies that each link has a simple link to the next part of the chain. I much prefer the phrase eating ecosystem. There is a complex set of interrelationships between farming, processing, and all the other bits that I've mentioned. But if you come away with nothing else, our single biggest economic activity is agri-food. The UK is a net contributor to Europe. Northern Ireland is a net beneficiary, and particularly agri-food. Farming at the minute is extremely challenged. It has some of the worst farm gate prices in dairy. To put it into context for you, roughly speaking, this year we could be looking at half the price for milk of 2 years ago. Imagine if your salary had halved. Without the support of the Common Agricultural Policy, farming couldn't exist and go forward, and those 100,000 jobs would be challenged. I recently had the privilege of being able to talk to the Prime Minister directly about this, although it is a bit daunting to meet the Prime Minister, and I wasn't quite sure what to say to him. The evening before I met him, I had happened to be watching the movie Men in Black 3, and I pointed out to the Prime Minister that the villain in that movie is called Boris the Animal, who's although he spends most of the movie saying, just call me Boris. We, as the Northern Ireland Food and Drink Association, representing the processors in the agri-food sector, are clearly anti-Brexit and have been from the beginning of this year. In fact, we were one of the first organisations to take a very clear stand on it. I have had no managing director of any food business take a different view. So we are not slightly divided on the issue. We are very clear on the issue. I've told you a little bit about who we are and our contribution to Northern Ireland. What do we need to grow? We need skilled young people, and from this platform I will compliment Minister Farry on his engagement and his work with us as an industry to help take the skills agenda forward. There is still more to be done, and in the interest of time I'll not say any more about that now. We need, I've discussed Brexit, and that's obviously very important to help us grow. We need access to international markets. Our colleagues in the south of Ireland can sell red meat to America. We can't. There is a good example of how we need market access, the ability to be able to go and sell our goods. And we also need an export marketing organisation to help us do that. Some of you may have heard of Bord Bia, or you may have heard of Scotland Food and Drink. Those are organisations set up to help their industry sell their food across the world. We need a similar organisation in Northern Ireland, and we have been working for years to try and get that. And I would ask for your support to help us get that into existence. I think in the year of food and drink, I think we struggle a little bit to accept how good we are at agri-food in Northern Ireland. We have won more Great Taste Awards as an industry than any other region in the UK. You might want to think about that for a second. We have outclassed every other region in the UK. And people say to me, Michael, but you would say that, wouldn't you? You know, what is the heritage of agri-food in Northern Ireland? And I'm going to finish with this in the interest of time. This is the country that gave the world the tractor.
Yes, thank you, Michael. And now we've obviously left the best wine to the very last. So, Professor Deirdre Heenan, please.
Okay, thank you very much. As you know, I could talk about lots of things, poverty, health and social care, mental health. But I think you won't be surprised to find when we're talking about Northern Ireland, I want to talk about education, skills and the knowledge economy. And I could talk until 6 o'clock this evening, but you'll be pleased to know I'm going to keep it short. What I do want to say to you, though, and what strikes me and has struck me this week is this week we had a report from the Public Accounts Committee. I don't know if it passed your notice. To my mind, it should have been front page news, but it wasn't. The report lambasted our education system. The report found that 40%, I'm going to say it again because I do think it's worth stating, 40% of our children are leaving post-primary schools without the bare minimum standards in maths and education. 40% leaving without GCSE, English and maths. Conference, I say to you, that is a national disgrace. And that follows on from an audit office report with similar findings just 2 years ago. They say that any progress in our education system is painfully slow. We are fixated with flags, parades, the past. In the meantime, our education system is failing our young people. And unfortunately, far too many people are happy to sit by and let it happen. I'd like to think that you are going to ensure that we can fix the education system. Little progress has been made. Why? How can this be acceptable? So when people say to you, and I hear them saying it in television, I hear them saying it at conferences, our education system is the jewel in the crown. I hope you challenge that assertion. I hope you say it's complete hogwash. We are failing far too many people, and we should not sit by and let it happen. Unfortunately for us, I think, and we're certainly not going to get into it now, the debate around academic selection has dominated the education system. And for all sorts of political reasons, it's become a toxic debate. So I say, let's set it aside for the moment and acknowledge that what we know about disadvantage is that disadvantage in terms of educational achievement is obvious by the time children go to primary school. So the issue is not age 10 or 11, it's much, much earlier. By the time children go to primary school, so the Scottish Government, for example, have developed an early intervention programme. They are saying you can target interventions. It is quite possible to predict which children are going to find it more difficult, and we target resources in those areas. Their policy demonstrates that the most important years in a child's life, the most four important years, are 0 to 3. I think we need to learn from the Scottish Government and learn from the research. What I also know from the Heenan Anderson Commission is we need to stop doing what we always do because it is not working. We need to move to more innovative measures in education. We need to address underachievement. We need models of intervention that work. And there are evidence of models that work. You may have noticed St. Paul's School in Bessbrook this week on the news. They tackled the issue. First of all, they acknowledged there was an issue, which is an important first step, I would say. But then secondly, they decided that they would be innovative. And the results show that it can work, that results can be achieved if you're determined to make a difference. So it may be politically incorrect, but I say we need to decommission the models that we are using because they are not working. Which takes me on to my other favourite subject at the moment, skills. We have 40% of children leaving school without GCS English and Maths. How are those children going to be part of a productive economy? Where are those children going to find their place in society? Can we stand by and say that's an acceptable Northern Ireland, a record that our devolved government should be proud of? I don't think so. I welcome the publication of the Skills Barometer, and I see the Minister has joined us. And of course, I have to give a plug for Ulster University and say it was a partnership with our Centre for Economic Policy and the department. But for the first time, we move towards evidence-based policy. So if you haven't got the Skills Barometer by your bedside cabinet, I'll send one to you all because it does make hugely significant reading. For the first time, it tells us what we need in Northern Ireland to be that modern, dynamic economy. Where are the gaps? What do we need to invest in? And there's now a detailed understanding of the skill requirement up to 2025. You won't be surprised to hear that the Skills Barometer said that there is very, very little room for people in the modern economy without qualifications. That we need to ensure that our children have qualifications. That's not to say they all must go to university, and quite rightly there's been an emphasis on apprenticeships and appropriate apprenticeships. And vocational training is also important. But qualifications are important in the knowledge economy. Corporation tax lowered clearly is not a panacea for the Northern Ireland economy. And anyone who tells you it is deluded. Frankly, quite deluded. As we in higher education and many others, including some of our politicians, have been at pains to point out, it is completely counterintuitive to talk about lowering the rate of corporation tax and at the same time cutting our skills base. If foreign direct investment and indeed our Indigenous businesses are to succeed, it will be because they've been attracted here because of our talented workforce, our skilled workforce. That's why they'll come. We are the only region in the developed world, think about that for a moment, the only region disinvesting in skills. Yet again, we seem to be quite content to stand by and let it happen. Completely counterintuitive and short-term. How are we ever going to be a productive economy that stands on our own two feet if we're not investing in our skills base and ensuring that our people are appropriately qualified? We are the only region of the UK that's a net exporter of students. This year, due to the cuts, 1,000 extra young people from Northern Ireland will leave for their higher education. And what we know from our research is they will not come back. So we're encouraging a brain drain at the same time that we want to become more productive. And what we do know is our research and development within the universities and our skilled graduates drive innovation, drive growth, and drive productivity. Barack Obama in his State of the Nation address said, "You can lighten the load of a plane by taking out the engine." but it won't be long before you notice the difference. And I say to you, yes, you can cut costs by cutting education. It won't be long before we notice the difference.
Has anybody like to use a roving microphone to ask a question? There's Malcolm at the back. Nice short questions would be appreciated.
Yes. The whole business of corporation tax, which has been alluded to, I actually disagree with the party's policy. It's only policy that I disagree with. I think it's very beggar thy neighbour situation, and there's no guarantee in any way that it'll work, and it's going to cost us £300 million a year, which we don't have. What is it? And of course, British government not let us fake profits away the way they do in the Republic of Ireland, where Google and Facebook fake their profits through our subsidiaries. What does the panel think of this reduction? And it's already been alluded to of corporation tax, because I do not think it will work, and it will take badly needed money out of the health service, maybe cost people's lives if money has to be taken out of the health service. Thank you.
Thanks, Malcolm.
Do you want to
answer to that?
Peter, volunteer, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose I would agree with you, obviously, because I don't see it as being the silver bullet. I think Deirdre is quite correct. What you do need is a talented workforce. And why I say that, I have a long history of working in the Republic of Ireland in the trade union movement. And people were not drawn to the Republic of Ireland purely for corporation tax, which all commentators think. A lot of nonsense. And the blunderbuss approach, which we're approaching it from, again, is a lot of nonsense, because there is nothing, there's no conditionality associated with it. So Peter Bunting Enterprises could be a beneficiary of the gap of the 7.5%, and put it in his back pocket. But I do believe that it is part of a parcel of tools, or part of the toolbox, as they call it nowadays, whereby it could add some form of an incentive. But if it's really going to contribute to economic growth, it has to be in the differential. We have to insist on the differential being invested in research and development, because, as Deirdre says, that drives the innovation, and that drives productivity, and that drives the economic growth. It may be also associated then with Michael's crew as well, the people he represents, with increasing exports. It may as well help the SMEs and give a differential if they set up enterprise zones where they are working on economies of scale and sharing market intelligence. So there are a number of factors which should be conditional on anyone receiving the gap. And by the way, a lot of people then won't get it, because they won't be doing too much to contribute to our economic growth. And the other point I really have is this. The people who will benefit will be the Treasury, because the income tax, if they do increase jobs, is going back to the Treasury. The welfare benefits bill then will then be reduced, which goes back to the Treasury. But at the same time, the collective amount of money which is lost to the Treasury in reduced taxation will then be taken off our education grant, the block grant, which will be again hit the education sector, which Deirdre has alluded to, hit the health sector, which you, my friend, have alluded to as well. So those are many, many reasons where this blunderbuss approach we have to corporation tax is a lot of nonsense. And the last point to just say to you is this. From my experience in the Republic of Ireland, you will note that East Cork, for example, has a huge range of Pfizers and stuff from the pharmaceutical industry. And what Waterford Institute of Technology did, and also the Cork Institute of Technology, they changed their total curricula away from accounting, away from law, away from wherever, and introduced science topics, with building up then a new pool, a skilled pool of laboratory technicians, etc., for those specific companies. So therefore, we need to deal with the whole matter in a broad approach to how we attract foreign direct investment. It is not just about lowering taxation. Thank you.
Peter, that's Jack.
Yeah.
I agree with Peter in the fact that it's not a silver bullet, and it's a tool or a lever that that can be used by the executive. But I just want to focus on the key aspect about the investment skills, because you can have whatever rate of corporation tax you're going to have, but if you don't have the investment in your skills, that's the thing that ultimately will attract foreign direct investment to come into Northern Ireland. So there has to be sustained investment in skills, and that has to be a long-term approach taken by the executive. And in terms of, with this date being 2 years away, really the new executive needs to get cracking on and ensure that if they're going to enable corporation tax to deliver what it can deliver, they have to get moving, and they have to come together with their plans and strategies and tactics as to how they can make this work. But ultimately, if there's not the investment in skills, it's going to make it very, very difficult. So,
okay. I can see Michael looking at me. I'm tempted to say, if we let you two answer the next question, if that's okay, you can refer back to this one if you want to. I would just say on the question of corporation tax, long before Brexit was ever mentioned, there was many a survey done about foreign direct investment and what was the main factors that would attract people to come to Northern Ireland to invest, and corporation tax wasn't even on the list. You know, collectivity was, transport, stable government was, equal society was mentioned, things like that, but corporation tax has come over the horizon in the last few years as being some sort of silver bullet. Now, we are, as a party, prepared to support the concept, but, you know, the jury's out. We'll wait and see. I've got another question here from somebody, but is there anybody who wants to ask an oral question? Yes, Tom.
I'm Tom Aiken. I used to be an Irish sponsor in Belfast.
I repeat that because it's very important.
No, we don't.
I am in business in Sandy Row, and we've built a wonderful business over the last 20 years, attracting a lot of inward investors, American companies largely, in high technology. But I pick up the general theme from the four speakers, and I'm slightly extrapolating. They are saying, we know the problems, we know the solutions, but we're not achieving them. Some of you might remember a lady called Katrina Ruan, who was Minister of Education. I had the dubious pleasure of sitting beside her at dinner one evening, and I said to her, will you stop worrying about the 11 plus and grammar schools? Will you start thinking about the kids that are on the street who are going to be the next bunch of terrorists?
What's the question?
And that is exactly what we're seeing. The question I'm asking is, we've known about this, what can we do about changing the attitude of A, the politicians, and B, the bureaucrats who are stopping us moving forward?
Okay. Well, that's a fair question. And one of the questions I was going to ask, perhaps, so which links to that, is very simple. What would you expect? What would you ideally expect from the Northern Ireland Executive in the next mandate to make it easier for us to trade inside or outside Europe, to make it easier for inward investment? So, Michael, do you want to go
okay.
first?
Thank you, Chair. I'll start with some real facts. Since the recession, Northern Ireland Food and Drink has doubled its turnover. We were 2.5 billion, we're now 5. We are employing 3,500 more people. So this is delivering jobs. It's delivering jobs across the education spectrum. So those are jobs for educational high achievers, and they are also jobs for educational lower achievers. Those jobs are also spread uniformly, more or less, across Northern Ireland. They are not focused in urban centres. There's a phrase which I like to use, Chairman, and I would encourage people to pick up. You will hear FDI bandied about at great length. Please balance it with the other side of the coin, which is LSI, Local Sustainable Investment. They are two sides of one coin. We were part, just to refer back to the previous question, we were part of GrowNI, the corporation tax lobby group. We do not see it as being the complete silver bullet. But to answer the second question, we need CT. We need planning. If I can briefly relate a story from one of our largest companies, they have three factories, one in the south of Scotland, one in the north of England, and one here. All three were needed extension and applied for planning permission to extend the factories. One got it in 8 weeks, and it was in a national park. The one in the north of England got it in 16 weeks. There was an argument about the colour of the shed. The one in Ballymena took over a year and a half. And as the chairman of the company said, it's not as if Harryville is an area of outstanding natural beauty. And then said, I probably shouldn't have said that. Another illustration. We must move our government from risk avoidance to risk management. I'll leave you with this last thought. We produce 600 tons of salmon a year on our coastline. We support one company. 16 miles away, they have a 1 billion industry supporting 2,000 jobs, producing 34,000 tons a year. Are you really telling me that on over 200 miles of coastline, all we can have is one salmon farm?
Okay, thank you, Michael. That salmon farm can be wiped out by a swarm of jellyfish, if I remember right, as well.
But it's still going strong.
Jerry.
I don't know if it's appropriate or not to say this at a political conference, but it seems to me that sometimes democracy is overrated.
Now you're talking. We're getting there.
And basically, we see that our politicians take very short-term views. It's about getting elected, and no sooner you're elected, you're thinking about getting re-elected. And what we have then are all sorts of short-term piecemeal policies. What I would like to see is politicians coming together and the political system coming together, and politics is too important to be left just to politicians also, I think it's fair to say, that we should be coming together as key stakeholders saying, what is the long-term ambition for Northern Ireland? What is it we want to look like in 20 years' time? How will we be revolutionised? And we don't have that long-term strategy. We don't have a long-term vision. And I think we are missing that collective ambition. Why couldn't we say, for example, instead of saying we have the highest rates of mental illness across the UK, that we are going to be a flagship for mental health, that we're going to invest in it, and people are going to say, oh, look what they did in Northern Ireland. We don't seem to have the ambition to say we could do this. Why couldn't we say, for example, that Northern Ireland is going to move to be in the top 10 for life expectancy across the world? And collectively, we will do it. That means moving out of your silo mentality and saying, how can you talk about health without talking about education? How can you talk about health without talking about infrastructure? So if you go back to the earlier conversation about corporation tax, and is it a panacea? Clearly it is not. And if you look to the Republic of Ireland, what did they do that we don't? They invested in their infrastructure. Our infrastructure is appalling. And as someone... as someone who came from Derry this morning, the fact that the two main cities are not linked by a motorway is incredible. By the way, I couldn't have gone back to Derry without saying that here. And I will say this, our executive decided it was a good idea to dual the road to a defunct port at Larne before they would dual the road to Derry. No offence to anyone at Larne, but the reality is our two cities are not joined. We don't make the most of our cross-border abilities in the northwest. So there are many, many issues that are long-term strategic issues. The trains, don't start me. Yeah. Well, I mean, when you can travel faster on your bicycle than the train from Derry to Belfast, really, I mean, that's enough said. So I think really what I'm saying is we need to invest in long-term strategic projects, in education, in mental health, and in our infrastructure.
Okay. Well, Deirdre, I appreciate all your comments. When you said that the south of Ireland invested heavily in its infrastructure, you're the only panelist who hasn't mentioned Europe, and it was actually Europe who invested in the southern infrastructure, which is another reason for staying in, I think, not to get political, you know. I'm getting wind-up noises here, so I'll just take one more quick question from Colm Kavanagh, if you don't mind.
From the northwest.
From the northwest. I would like to ask again the question I think that Tom Egan was asking for Belfast, and I asked Professor Heenan. I think everybody in this room shares your frustration about the lack of A-levels, including English and maths. Now, a whole lot of those people don't go to your university, but do you have any views on how we can get out of that situation and improve it?
In no particular order.
What was the question? I didn't catch it, sorry.
Sorry, I wanted to ask the university whether about the people who get who leave school, and 40% of them do not have English and maths at GCSE. No. How do we cure that situation?
Okay, well.
They don't go to university, also most of them.
No, they don't, but I mean, Jerry makes an offering. We make an offering through Union Ireland, which is wonderfully supported by Minister Farrey as well. It's one of the things we do, where we educate people through the trade union movement with an arrangement with the employer to learn the basic skills of literacy, numeracy, and IT specifically. And what we do then is we have an agreement. We do a learning needs analysis in companies. We get the agreement with the company, and for every 2 hours study they do, they get 2 hours off the factory from work. And what they do then is, between either the trade unions or some of the companies, we then get a computer suite into the factory, outside the factory line, and we utilise that as skilling up people. Because one of the interesting things about it is, even those people who are at work, about 75% of those will still be there in 2020. And they don't have the necessary skills either. So if you're a potential employer who wants to grow your company, and as it will become more technological to put productive new measures and technology, we need to be upskilling our current employees and those of the potential. And in relation to your, both Tom's point and your own point, I think there's more we could do. But some of it relates to the fact that an apprenticeship is not as valuable as a university degree. I think balancing that up a bit, because we have a certain snobbery associated with vocational learning and academic learning. And yet, at one stage during the Celtic Tiger in Dublin, you couldn't get an electrician, and the plumbers were commanding a hell of a lot more money than the local lawyer was. That was a certainty, because they're in slow demand. So we have to convince people of getting into other educations. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, we should, like Queen's did, reduce their learning on classicals and all. I think that's very important as well. But for a broad society, we need to get that balance right, where Maggie next door or Sammy next door, whose son and daughter wants to go for an apprenticeship, that it's not frowned upon. Okay. And they all, I mean, you look around Belfast, I walk around Belfast, and I wonder how all those solicitors and legal companies are actually surviving. Because every building is a solicitor's office, and next door to that comes accounting. And I wonder, well, maybe there's a type of legitimate society, you know that, but those are things I think we should be doing.
I can feel a hobby horse coming on.
I think maybe to go back to your question about what do we do about it. I think everyone in the audience, if you ask yourself, we in Northern Ireland refer to good schools and bad schools. We all know bad schools, and you want your children to go to a good school. That seems to be acceptable. I'm saying it should not be acceptable. Every school should actually be a good school. And we should have a system in place to ensure that every school is a good school. Then actually the 11 plus and academic selection would become irrelevant, because we would all be going to good schools. So what we need to do is raise aspirations. We need to raise standards as a matter of urgency. The fact that schools can have so many children leaving without qualifications appears to be completely acceptable. I can't understand why, why we can't move to zero tolerance, that we're saying, actually, this is not acceptable. Let's go into the school and see what's going wrong. Because we have examples where leadership has turned schools around. And you cannot accept a view that says these children can't attain. These children are too disadvantaged. Absolute garbage. Okay. If there's a will, there's a way. Yeah. If you're determined to bring those children out, you will do it.
Okay, I'm going to do Miss Stephen Nolan imitation here. A quick word from Jerry, on the if you want to.
Very quickly, and Colin, you know this, because many of those young people who are leaving at the age of 16 without the requisite qualifications do enter into an FE college. And you know, I think Deirdre referenced the skills barometer earlier on. That's a very, very important piece of research, and it details where the skills gaps will be over the next decade, and particularly where FE comes in at levels 3, 4 and 5, where we're putting much more emphasis on the economic importance of that. Yet we're still, significant parts of the FE budget are still addressing the failings of schools where between 35-40% of young people leaving without the requisite GCSEs. That's an indictment of society. Like 29% of our current working age population don't have any formal qualifications. If we're going to grow this economy and truly take us in, you know, I think the title here this afternoon was about making it Northern Ireland the most attractive or the best regional economy. Mm-hmm. We have to deal with the failures that are out there. Okay. And it really does. It hinders FE, it hinders the university sector when you've got significant failings in the post-primary sector. 12 years of education okay. without coming out with a GCSE in English
and
mathematics.
But I also think it's important to say at this point, the two universities have, and not counting the colleges, have 50,000 students, all with English and maths, all role models for young people in primary schools. Mm-hmm. Couldn't we surely develop a system where they're in schools raising standards?
Right, clearly, I'll never be a radio presenter. Michael, last word.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time educating people what is Northern Ireland's largest company. And the answer is Moypark. How many people do they employ? And the answer is 12,000. Quite a significant number of that are foreign nationals. Why? We can't get young people who want to work. Michael, the wages are rubbish. No, they're not. Typical average minimum wage in agri-food is 22,000 a year. It's twice national minimum wage. What do we need? We need people that can read and count, ideally, and who want to work. We are short of people. We are bringing people in. You can go onto our website and get our manifesto. We are actually arguing for a migration advisory committee skills shortage list for Northern Ireland to allow us to bring in the skills that we can't get locally. That's an even further indictment of the fact that we can't get those people locally and that the system can't supply them for us.
Okay, well, I think that's been a very useful discussion, and I'm glad so many of you stayed to listen to it, because quite often this shift is a bit more empty than this. So well done, but it was well worthwhile to wait. Could you please thank Peter, Jerry, Michael, and Deirdre?